Dear listeners, welcome to the Public Perception of Science podcast.
My name is Lieven Heremans.
And mine is Bram Harkema.
As you might know, the role of academic research in society is undergoing some serious discussions at the moment. For us as students, this discussion was actualized by last year's Maagdenhuis appropriation in Amsterdam. We feel the need to investigate and reflect academically upon the public perception of science and academia. Therefore, we set up this lecture series at Utrecht University in early 2016.
The guest lectures you will hear in this series come from different Dutch universities and have different disciplinary backgrounds. All speakers have in some way attributed to this discussion.
In this third lecture, you will hear Trudy de Huy, philosopher of science in the field of psychology, affiliated with the University of Groningen. She criticizes the way scientific findings are presented as facts and argues that scientists should be more open about their definitions because they come before the fact. You can find the slideshow on De Omslag, the website where this podcast is published.
Today is about, I turned around your topic, public perception of science. That is an issue, a much debated issue. The public has to have the good perception of science. And I turned it around, what actually is the academic perception of the public? Which I think is often lacking. The academics don't have a good perception of the public, and hence the other way around. The public doesn't have a good perception of science. It's a two-way thing. Here is something the Dutch government is very, very proud of right now, which is the National Science Agenda. And in a way, it's a nice thing. It was organized last year, and the big audience was asked, what do you think scientific researchers should study? And they expected, the organization expected a few questions, but they got 11,000 questions from the public. So they were kind of shocked, and they had to organize all kinds of things. And if you go to YouTube, you can see a clip they made about this National Science Agenda. And if you pay attention, you can see that people regard science and the academic sector as a kind of Santa Claus. They ask, can you do this for me? Can you organize this for me? Can you do that? Can you do that? So I've been living at a canal in the city of Groningen where the boat with Santa Claus comes in every year. And the children will throw in papers into the water, and there will be black and multicolored Peters sitting in little boats and picking up the papers with the questions. And lo and behold, after a couple of weeks, the child gets what it wanted because it was on the paper. But children don't have to ask at the expense of what has this plastic toy been made. Was there child labor involved? Is it a good idea to have this plastic toy? The children are allowed to simply want some things, and maybe sensible parents don't give it to them. That would be a good idea quite often. But here we have this, the same model with this National Science Agenda. We ask you questions and you spit out the right answers. There are no right answers. And I propose that the public will not be treated as these Santa Claus children. And I will talk about this at the Science in Transition, next Science in Transition meeting. I think it's Tuesday or Wednesday. We have a panel about it, and there will be somebody from the Rethink, the students from the Rethink movement as well. So maybe it will become an interesting day. But this is the issue I want to talk about. And I'm not the only one. It's always very good to back up your statement with real authorities. Here is Helga Nowotny. She's the president of the European Research Council. And she also argues there's much work to do about the academic perception of the public. And she, for years, even before she became president of the European Research Council, she distinguished Mode 2 science from Mode 1 science. Mode 1 science is science on the Olympus. The populace ask questions, and the gods on the Olympus tell them the truth. They give back the answers. They know what to do, and they know what reality is, etc. And she proposes we should have mode two science, science on the agora, science that knows its limitations and also listens to the knowledges of people who are not at the academia, because you can learn a lot from them. And maybe a bit more about my background. I'm sorry because you already gave so much. But I started out with a school for higher vocational education and worked in a child psychiatric clinic. So I worked in actual practice, and there you learn that there are all kinds of knowledges. And I think that really colored my view. So doctors and teachers, etc., they have their own kinds of knowledges, which are important. And more people are beginning to see this now. This is a report by the European Science Foundation about the big, big, big problems the world is being confronted with right now. And it argues that these problems cannot only be tackled by academics. So there needs to be another knowledge system. Academics tend to argue in a disciplinary way, and they get their questions out of their own discipline, and they handle the questions with their own instruments. And this report says we need to go to an open knowledge system rather than a closed one. And I like this scheme. It's badly drawn. They should have hired an artist to do it better. But I like the text about the closed and the open system. The closed system, it says, science acts as if science finds the answers and tells the others what to do. That is the regular system. And the open system provides one of the sources of knowledge. That's what science does, according to the open system. People use the expressions of an interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary environment that is needed. Interdisciplinary is academic disciplines need to work together, and transdisciplinary is we also need to learn from people outside academia, not only in the industries, of course. We can also learn from people working, for instance, in pharmaceutical industries. Because I've published about pharmaceutical industries, people sometimes think I'm against them, but I'm not. I'm against misbehavior, but not against industries. So we can also learn from industries, but also from teachers and doctors, etc., etc. I wrote this article. Oh, yeah, that's this article. You read it. Most of you, maybe. And I think one of the most important things lines in this article is that the sorrow of science is that it's only admired for what it cannot be. And hence, what it does, it constantly has to keep up appearances and then starts to believe in its own appearances, namely that it can reflect reality. And I don't know, you're mostly in the humanities, and that may be a little bit different. I'm talking probably about other kind of researchers than you are. I'm working in the social science department, and my colleagues really believe that their research reflects realities. And natural sciences often believe that too, although in physics they know their models are theoretical, but in the social sciences, and especially in psychology, they really think if they use their statistical methods correctly, then their research reflects reality. And brain scientists really believe they speak on behalf of the brain. They can do that. And I contest that. But I do that first by giving a little bit of history, which you may already be familiar to. Who were the first ones who wanted to, or the first ones in the textbook, first ones who wanted to establish research on reality? That was the Vienna Circle, the logical positivists of the Vienna Circle. But they, very early on, they discovered that realism isn't possible. Realism defines knowledge based on neutral observation and logic. That's what is being called the view from nowhere. Is this familiar to you? Yeah, to most of you. They realized, very soon they realized it's not possible. As soon as you start to talk about what your sensory input, you start to interpret it. It's impossible to talk about it in a neutral way. For instance, we can see when we look up the sky on a clear night, we can see those lights over there, we call them stars. But what is immediately given? What is only those lights up there? So we started to use telescopes, etc. And of course, the telescopes co-determine what we see. And in addition, this is one very old drawing that already mocks that idea that with your telescope you can have objective knowledge. It's a bit sexist too, but in a complex way. For both. It's sexist for both. So this challenges the very notion that most neutral observation is through a telescope. In addition, who put up those names out there? There are no name tags in the sky saying this is a planet and this is Pluto and this is Uranus, etc., etc. Like I always add, there are no name tags in the brain. In my department, nearly all the psychologists believe that there is a name tag ADHD or autism or schizophrenia in your brain. It's not. There are at best differences in blood flows in brains. And it's people who first classified the research subjects with the help of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. No name tags in the brain. Maybe you remember the discussion about is Pluto a planet or is it not a planet? That was quite a discussion about, I think, 10 years ago. And here's a scheme, and I like the scheme because it gives the facts. Facts are the measurements. Well, these are already mediated measurements. You need instruments for them, and the way the instruments have been built determines the facts. And then the facts can be evoked for the conclusion. Yes, Pluto is a planet, or no, Pluto is not a planet. So whether or not a fact counts on behalf of the yes or the no answer, depends on your arguments. So arguments always precede the facts. It's what this book is showing. And in a way, the logical empiricists already knew that. They sensed that. Next came one of the most famous philosophers of science, Karl Popper, who, I guess you will know, argued that the facts are based on a moor, so not on steady ground, but on a moor. And he evoked Einstein, who said, "Erst die Theorie entscheidet darüber, was man beobachten kann." Without a theory, one cannot even observe. I have a clipping here of Karl Popper, but I skipped this one. I talked through him. I stop him. It's too soft. I can't stop him. Okay. What he says, I had to teach in front of a class of physics students. And these physics students all thought their science can reflect reality or does reflect reality. So I started out with telling them, observe. And then they asked, what should we observe? Okay. And that was his trick, to make them aware that you always start out from assumptions. And the clip is in a way nice because he still has big fun. He's 86 years old here, and he still enjoys his trick. I'm going to show another clipping out of this interview, in which he argues that in the name of certainty, more damage has been done than in the name of uncertainty. He says science is basically uncertain, and that's not a problem. And he refers to the 20th century and the wars in the 20th century, and he argues we should know there is no certainty.
Popper's kennisleer is een pleidooi voor het streven naar waarheid. Dit streven is niet onmogelijk, zoals het relativisme stelt, want met iedere weerlegde theorie komen wij een stap dichter bij de waarheid. In het bezit van de waarheid zullen we echter nooit komen.
So we have to regard our theories as hypotheses. That is to say, we hope they are true. If they are not true, we hope to find out that they are not true. But what we do not can achieve is certainty. Most people believe that truth means certain truth, but that is a mistake.
But I think that most people would say that that is what we hoped for, that is what we need.
Yes, that's what you can't get. You have to learn that. People don't want to live in uncertainty.
No.
But after all, if they think a little, they know that they have to live in uncertainty.
It cannot be helped, even by science.
Certainly not.
Okay, so here's Popper saying we have to live with uncertainty, but a next step in philosophy of science and sociology of science has been taken by people like Bruno Latour, who argue, well, yes, maybe facts are based on assumptions, that's right, but these assumptions can become very true. So people like Popper act as if everything is uncertain, but science creates certainties without admitting that it does so, and that may be quite undemocratic. So I give the floor to Latour for a while.
Do scientists discover facts?
No, the notion of discovery is a very bad way of rendering what scientists do, and it's actually a very unfair way of doing, because it sort of erases the work scientists have to do in order to discover. So the notion of discovery is certainly not one of those notions that can be kept in the study of science. So we turn around words which have to do with construction, constitution of fact, which doesn't mean that the facts are not there. It means that they are made of lots of things, including scientific practices, instruments, community, laboratory, museums like that, collections. For instance, here, you cannot even think of classifying crystallography or geology without the drawers, without the collections, without the institution of this museum at the École des Mines. So the notion of discovery is a very bad way. But so here, if I was a crystallographer, which I'm not, I would be able to use these collections, these drawers, these specimens, these diagrams there, these maps, in order to speak in the name of what the crystals down there in the earth are. But they are no longer down there on the earth. They are mobilized, they are socialized, they are presented, they are made coherent inside this institution of a museum.
But whatever you say, crystals do what they do, independent from your sayings.
Well, if they were independent, they wouldn't be here in this room. If they were independent, if they were nature as they are, they wouldn't be in this room, right? They would be down in the earth. You wouldn't see them. So they are not independent. They are mobilized. They have been brought here. They are given labels. They are highly theorized specimens excerpted from the earth. All of this work is the work of a scientist. By just thinking of the crystals as independent, you discount the work of a scientist. You discount precisely what is all the energy, what is the specificity, what they think day and night is, how can I mobilize crystals inside the science of crystallography? So precisely, they are no longer things themselves. They are things inside the network of crystallographers, collections, geology, museums, and so on.
So what he says here is that science does not so much discover as create, recreate reality. And more philosophers and sociologists of science are arguing in this vein now, me too. Doing research is not so much a matter of discovery as a matter of carving out paths. So not, the paths are not already there. They're being carved out by scientists. And if we keep up the metaphor of discovery, then many people will have to work the paths that have been carved out by the scientists, but they don't have any say in it. So reality is there, I would say, but what we make out of reality, that is something that's what human beings do. I sometimes compare it in my mind to clay. There is clay, but you can make many, many things out of clay. Not everything. Reality pays resistance. You cannot make everything out of clay, maybe not a human being, but many things. Now, science recreates realities. That's easy to understand if you think of technology. Cars recreate realities because you can go quicker from A to B. At light bulbs recreated reality, and birth control pills recreated realities. But not only in a technical sense. First of all, there is design in the technology, man-made design, man-made decisions. Next, they also recreate social realities. Birth control pills have recreated social realities. I think it's an advantage that people don't get pregnant, still can have sex without becoming pregnant. That's a recreation of reality. That has recreated the relationships between men and women, but also between parents and children. Because a child, having a child now, is a very deliberate choice. And everything you very deliberately choose for is much more your own responsibility than things that happen to you. And that might be an explanation for the phenomenon of anxious parenting these days. Parents think, oh my God, the child is my own choice and I'm so responsible. So they may be much more responsible for their child, feel much more responsible than they would be in the old days. My mother often told me I was a crybaby, and then she explained me what she did with me. She put me in the shed. If you do that now as a parent, my God. She said, well, we put you in the shed and we waited until you were finished. Look at me, I'm not that unhappy. And this is all technology, but there's more technology in the making or already there. Here are some examples from DARPA, the research department of the Pentagon. And they already have these insects that you can steer from a distance. If you Google backyard brains, you will see that young researchers already have stolen this technology. You can buy equipment from them to catch pop in the dangles? The first stage of an insect. A butterfly first was a larva, something like that, yeah. And you insert microelectronics in the larva, and then you get an insect which you can steer from a distance. You can buy the equipment if you like to. They also already have equipment to steer soldiers' brains from a distance. So this is really very clear science that changes reality. Here is a report, Novel Neurotechnologies. It's a very good report by an independent body, composed by an independent body, Nuffield Council, and it gives you an overview of everything which is already available or is in the making. So that is changing reality onto the level, the finest level of brains. It's on a molecular level, which we already could do with antidepressants and other medications. Here is optogenetics. You insert a brain with a virus containing genes of algae, and then you can steer the brain from a distance using light. And MIT, if you Google YouTube optogenetics, you will see rats running through the corridors of MIT. And I recently heard a psychiatrist told me that at the University of Utrecht, the psychiatry department was already discussing using optogenetics in patients. Maybe it's helpful, and medications intervene in the brain too, but I think we should have discussions about, is this the path we want to walk? And I'm a bit worried when I use the word optogenetics on Google Images to find an image for you. I arrived at this site of the Telegraph, over 2 million likes, I said, oh my God, is there nobody who says, can we talk about this? Or is this just discovery of reality? Of course not. Well, these may be exciting examples, but I'm going to far more simple examples now, which is poverty in the Netherlands. Here's a map of poverty in the Netherlands. Well, yeah, Groningen is in the red, Amsterdam is in the red. What should your first question be when you see a map like this? According to me, what should your first question be according to me?
What is poverty?
Yeah, what counted as poverty? Yeah, because of course the definition precedes the facts, and the definition becomes hardened in numbers, and then the numbers create policy, but it's still the definition that actually creates the policy. And if we don't ask about the definitions, well, then we remain pretty stupid. It's not that hard, because here's an article from the NRC Handelsblad, more children grow up in poverty, but it had an insert, what counts as poverty? And it gives all kinds of definitions. And then the public becomes aware, oh yeah, of course, research is based on definitions, so it's not that difficult. And it's not only what counted as poverty, but also what kinds of people did we count in? Groningen and Amsterdam are in the red. Yeah, but there are many students. Were the students counted in? They are low-income people. Or what do we do with the people living in big houses, having big cars in front of the house, but can't afford the fuel for the car anymore because they can't pay their mortgage? Are they poor? The closest are still rich, maybe, as you can see on this rather silly drawing. So this is all a matter of definitions. The definitions are much more important than the actual figures. And next, the figures are not neutral. The figures do things. Figures are kinds of speech acts, like words can be speech acts, but figures can be speech acts too. Here's an interesting article by a psychologist and a psychiatrist. They compare the removal of Pluto from the class of planets and the removal of homosexuality from the class of mental disorders. When Pluto was decided that Pluto should not count as a planet, and that was decided by hand-raising. Not by measurement, but by hand-raising. Homosexuality was removed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorder, also by hand-raising. And they argue that the process of hand-raising should be improved. But to me, the most important thing of the article is that it makes people aware how much research is based on definitions, which have immense consequences. And there's a big debate going on whether there's a difference in consequences for non-human objects like Pluto. Should we mourn Pluto for not being a planet anymore? And human beings. That's a philosophical debate we maybe can go into later on. To continue on the example of homosexuality. Is homosexuality something biological that has always existed? When you go in Tuscany to a museum, you will see sometimes much more explicit drawings on pots and pans than this one. You see really sexual acts on the pots and pans. And I always figure, oh, would they be on the table, on the dinner table, etc.? If they were, that even more testifies to the notion, to the idea, that homosexuality has not always existed. Why not? Because this behavior didn't have to be mentioned. People didn't have to be classified according to their sexual preferences. Like orange eaters. We don't have a name for orange eaters. We don't set them apart as kind of people we can study and put them in brain scanners, etc. We do it with people with particular sexual preferences. For a long time, mankind didn't do that, but, well, maybe not such a long time, because the Catholic Church started to argue this is a sin. And through the ages, it became a matter of delinquency Oscar Wilde was put in jail for it. And then there were doctors who said, well, it may be, this may be delinquent behavior, but it's due to a mental disorder, and the mental disorder is called homosexuality. And from that time, there were groups, homosexuals and heterosexuals. And of course, when you use such an, when you classify people and use particular names for them, that has consequences. Then they become different kind of people. People with a mental disorder, with a diagnosis, are not the same people anymore. And at the beginning, as to homosexuality, oh yeah, it entered the diagnostic and statistical mental DSM, the first edition and the second, and that changed the lives of these people, and for some, for the better. This doctor I just showed, he wasn't mean; he was helping these people at the time, and the DSM was helping people too. Because, well, compared to the United States now or Russia now, there still is preferring people with similar bodies still is a matter of sin or delinquency. In Iran, you even can get hung for it. And if the other option is that you are bad, most people prefer to have a mental disorder, of course. Mental disorders are often my example. I write a lot of them, and people will tell me, well, many people are happy when they get a diagnosis. Yeah, I can understand that, because if the other option is that you're bad, then you prefer a diagnosis. And a diagnosis also refers to kinds of help, etc. Yeah, sure, of course you're happy. But it's a two-sided sword. It also says that you're not allowed to be what you are. You're still being classified and you're still being told that you should be different. And people who were classified as homosexuals, which was a disorder, started to protest against this back in the 70s. Here you have a man, a psychiatrist, John Fryer, at the 1972 Association meeting of the American Psychiatric Association. He looks strange. That's because he's wearing a big mask and a very big suit, and he had a voice. His voice was changed mechanically, and he was talking about those 81 words in the DSM about homosexuality as a mental disorder, which ruined his life. Because he couldn't even practice as a psychiatrist. If you have a mental disorder yourself, you can't practice, at least at the time, you can't practice psychiatry. And HBO, I read somewhere that HBO is turning this into a movie, and it's really a moving story. People were picketing outside, here they are, about the same issue. And what intrigues me now is her sign. Her sign says, homosexuals should be judged as individuals. It doesn't say people should not be classified according to their sexual preferences. So she says they are not. They argue we should be out of the DSM, but they don't argue, don't name us after our very, very private life. And that's a fascinating thing. So here's a 19th century invention, classification, and that became a truce. Homosexuality was removed from the DSM, but it became an ever more true reality through science, mostly. Because there were tests for homosexuality, like questions like, how often do you have sex with people with such body or that body? So you could measure it. Correlational research of homosexuality. I unfortunately don't know where I got these graphs from anymore, so I can't properly read them. But it seems to say that the older brothers of heterosexuals are a bit taller than the older brothers of homosexuals. You can all do all kinds of research with hetero or homosexuals. You can do epidemiological research of homosexuals. In which states are living how many, You can do that. You can do brain research of homosexuality. And as I said, there are no name tags in the brain. You can first use the tests to determine who counts as a homosexual and who as a heterosexual, but then you use criteria. Then you group them together, you send them to an fMRI apparatus, and you scan their brains. But that doesn't say that the homosexuality is in the brain. The brain, at best, shows blood flow. Genetic research of homosexuality. And this seems to make, or does make, it truer and truer and truer. Now, the example of homosexuality, of course, can be applied to each of the over 300 categories of mental disorder that are in the DSM. They don't reflect reality, they reflect what people think should count as a disorder. And that counting as has a lot of consequences for individuals, beneficial or not beneficial, sometimes beneficial, not always, and for society at large. And since I'm talking about the idea that science reflects reality, which I argue it doesn't, but creates reality, I introduce a concept, which you may know, and I apply it to the mental disorders, but you can apply it to much more. And the concept is reification. Have you heard about reification? Yeah, most of you have. Turning definitions into things. Well, if I have to explain it, it took me a lot of effort to explain it to larger audiences. It's very difficult. Groups of doctors have so much trouble understanding it. So this is how I explain it. Step one, define characteristic X as disorder Y. Step two, turn things around, argue that disorder Y expresses itself in characteristic X, or even that it's characteristic X is a symptom of disorder Y. So you turn things around. And nearly all scientific articles about mental disorders start with ADHD is a common mental disorder expressing itself in. So here's the reification. All these articles start with reification. And when I try to discuss this with my colleagues at the psychology department, they have much trouble understanding me. So we use simple examples. Maybe I don't do people justice because it's quite a ridiculous example, but it works. That's the example of drapetomania. Some may have heard of you. Here's another benevolent 19th century doctor who says, when a slave flees, is fugitive, you shouldn't shoot him or her, because that's a mental disorder. Trapetomania is the flying away disorder. So in this article, Diseases and Peculiarities of the Negro Race, it's still on the net, and it's really, really fascinating because there's lots of brain research in it, lots of certainties. He tells us that even their brains are black. If you cut them open, you get black brains. And he's very certain about himself. And it's amazing. It's not that long ago. But I'm talking about reification. Of course, we now understand that it's not the drapetomania that makes them run away. It's the circumstances under which they have to live. Here's another example that makes it easy to understand. There's a present-day example. A pharmaceutical company produced a medication against narcolepsy. Narcolepsy is the disease that makes you, like I would drop down now and fall asleep right now on the spot, or behind a wheel in the car. But they got a broader license for more, to give it to more people. And for that, they invented the disorder SWD. SWD is shift work disorder. The shift work disorder makes you tired when you have to do night shifts. And it's a fascinating, it's not your fault, it's your shift work disorder. And people will feel comforted, it's a shift work disorder, oh yeah. But we understand that this is a redefinition of people's need for sleep. And if we are not aware of that, then it can easily happen that our 24 hours economy will be get a boost from the notion, oh, you don't really don't have to sleep. Poor you, or you're so tired, you can't help it. Here's your pill. That changes social relations. The very notion that science reflects reality changes reality. So reification, turning things in different definitions into things, suggesting that nature tells us what should count as a disorder, or the denial that science creates realities. It's not only pharmaceutical companies. Of course, pharmaceutical companies do this very often, but researchers do it constantly, all the time. Here is Nature with an article saying mental disorders affect more than a third of Europeans. Look at the word affect. The mental disorders are reified. They are things. They do things. They are definition. What counted as a mental disorder? European commissioner, if that's the right word, Nelly Kroes, she acted upon these articles in Nature, and she gave, I don't know how many tons of money to further brain research at the expense of all other kinds of research. For instance, the humanities, who study what concepts do and who are aware that concepts precede research. So she handed over there a clip. She's so proud of herself. She, oh my God, third of the Europeans suffer from a mental disorder. I was looking at the clips and thought, well, are you ever coming out of the European Parliament? Are you in the real world still? A third of Europeans suffer from a mental disorder? Come on. Depends on how you define it. This article in Nature did not define it. I had to search for the definition that was used and found it in another article about a $1 trillion brain drain caused to mental disorders, which are brain disorders. And it was not only tumors, traumatic brain injury, which I think are rightly called brain disorders, although that's a matter of definition too, but also headaches, sleeplessness, anxiety, bad moods, bad personalities. They're all brain disorders. Well, if you do that, that's not neutral. It's a matter of classification. It's not neutral. It has consequences. And I showed you this report before. This report warns the European Brain Council. It says if you do that, then in the near future, we will only have brain technology to solve misery. All misery will be translated into brain defects, and we don't take any social measures anymore when people suffer. This one I already showed you. And what happens if you reify the disorders? If they are things that can come from somewhere and attack you, then you can divert from the definitions in the DSM and say they also express themselves in less symptoms. Actually, they are definitions, but people forget they are definitions. And that's because the reification, the suggestion that the definitions reflect nature. And then the argument is you can also have it in, it can express itself in less symptoms. You can see that everywhere. Here's an example, a leaflet, ADHD making the invisible visible. What? When I worked in a child psychiatric clinic, we didn't use the word ADHD often because this was at the beginning of the 80s and the word wasn't around yet. But the children whom we thought were really troublesome, they were really troublesome. You could see it in 5 minutes. What is invisible ADHD? You can only say that if you reify. And as I said, it's often pharmaceutical companies, and this was sent around, also in the Netherlands, as if it came from parliament.eu. That was the address that sent it around. It's a leaflet, it's a booklet. And psychiatrists in the Netherlands already started to tweet, oh, the European Parliament has said that the invisible ADHD should be made visible. But if you would check, you could see that on the leaflet there are three names of full professors, one from Groningen University. But it actually was written by a commercial text bureau. And the people who sent it around were the European Brain Council, together with the pharmaceutical firm Shire, that wants to sell a very, very expensive ADHD medication in Europe now, and a true amphetamine. So this, often it's not only connected to commercial interests, but commercial interests are often involved. And the European Brain Council is not a neutral body. If you go to the website, you can see that it is a lobby organization by biotech companies together with academics and patients' organizations. So Nature publishes these figures by the European Brain Council, but there are lots of commercial interests involved here. Not always. I was talking about if you reify, if you act as if science speaks on behalf of nature, you can also argue that mental disorders express themselves in less symptoms. And here is a group of brain researchers doing the same. BrainScan promises to identify the hidden sufferers of autism. And I checked whether the original scientific article... Oh, it's not here. I checked whether the original scientific article said the same. Yes, it did. Autism could in the future be diagnosed in 50 minutes from a brain scan, saving patients and their families years of suffering from a condition that can go unrecognized for decades. I'm happy you laugh, because for some people, for doctors, this is difficult to understand. So then I have to explain, yeah, maybe, but you change the definition of autism. When I worked at the beginning of the 1980s in a child psychiatric clinic, there was one diagnosis we knew. We didn't work with diagnoses. There's one we knew that was autism. If a child was brought in with the diagnosis of autism, you would see in 1 minute that something was seriously wrong and that this is really a problem for parents and that they should get help and that medicalization is a good idea, etc. But can go unrecognized for decades? That's really weird, because you change the definition. I know that people can hide symptoms. I know that people can hide being very unhappy. But if you say they are depressed too, then you also use a definition. Maybe you can say, as long as you can hide it, we don't use the word depression. So, and we can't talk about this if science acts as if it reflects reality. Here's another example. Hidden ADHD among adults. In adults, ADHD expresses itself in less symptoms. It already says that 5% of the Dutch population, it compares countries, 5% of the Dutch adult population has ADHD. That is 630,000 people, whereas right now among 80,000 people take medications against ADHD, so that's 5% is a lot. And then they end the article by saying it should be more, because in adults, ADHD expresses itself in less symptoms. That's reification. In the end, everybody has ADHD. That's not innocent, because if you classify something that refers, that changes realities. That's the thesis of my entire talk. And here's another article from the same group that says that the entire working population in the Netherlands should be tested for ADHD because it's bad for the economy. Very seriously, in serious scientific journals. I pictured them knocking on the door of my office. Hello, can we please test you? It's amazing. It's very serious. They designed the test already. And again, this also has to do with pharmaceutical companies. This stems from Harvard University, the World Mental Health Survey Initiative. The lead researcher at Harvard is Ronald Kessler. It's an international conglomerate of researchers. But if you look at underneath Kessler's articles, you can see that he's a consultant for all the big pharmaceutical companies. And the articles I just showed to you, if you look underneath, It's they mention all the pharmaceutical companies that sponsored this research, concluding that in the Netherlands, 5% of the adult population has ADHD. But also without pharmaceutical companies, we have this notion of science mirroring reality. And even in a deeper sense, doing research is much more than just measuring and calculating. First you have the classification, you have the interpretation of facts, and in the middle you have the measuring and counting. And there's also the question, what counts as good counting and measuring? That's also a matter of definitions. It's not nature that tells us what counts as good measuring and counting. Once you have a definition of we're going to count the number of homicides or poverty or ADHD or whatever, once you have that definition, you have to translate the definition in research skills. And there's the next step of design. For instance, you have the epidemiological research of ADHD, Netherlands 5%, etc., etc. It's the same group who made this chart, this map. But in doing their research, there's a lot of design involved. In actual medical practice, before a person gets a diagnosis of ADHD, they work for a day with a person. This kind of research, and it should be done by medical specialists, the day of testing, etc. For this kind of research, they hired like students who went from door to door and asked 5 questions. And then the conclusion was drawn, oh, this person has ADHD and this person not. Same for measuring homosexuality in the states of America. Well, once you have a definition, how do you measure the definition? Do you go to people's bedroom? Or do you go to the pub with them? Or do you ask them questions? This is all a matter of design, which highly influences the outcomes. As to ADHD, the figures range from 2% to 11% in the same population, depending on all these definitions. And I dig deeper. Here is the famous experiment, randomized clinical trial. It compares experimental groups and control groups. And think of testing an SSRI, an antidepressant, against a placebo. And we're all being told that this is a very, very, very neutral research design. It's not neutral at all. All the research was often about this kind of research. It argued it's not neutral at all. Very Western neoliberal values are included in the design. But I'm not going into this older research. I'm going into my newer one and explain that it can't be neutral for one very simple reason to start with. What counts as depression? You need to have definitions of depression to do these kind of tests. For instance, they first have to be done with rats and mice. Have you ever wondered in this kind of research what counts as a depressed rat? How do you get a depressed rat? You need a definition. You make it, yeah. For instance, yeah, that's one definition. Sorry?
Punch it,
yeah. Well, actually, yeah, you need something. Yeah, you're all right. In the old research, they would confront the males with a stronger male. And you know you get depressed from that. And they isolated the females from their families. Maybe it's all sexism in this kind of research. And what they do now, they breed them. They breed many generations of dull pairs. Here, I like this a lot. Cyagen, that you can buy your mice or rats. And it says, we help you discover life. And then next it says, custom transgenics, mice or rats, and get a 50% discount. So They made them. They didn't discover them, they produced them. They produced new kinds of life. And then you have your next question, what counts as a no longer... Next question, what counts as a no longer depressed rat or mouse? And I phoned the son of a friend. I knew he was 14 at the time. He had rats in his bedroom. So I phoned him and said, Anthony, when? How do you know they are happy? And he knew, he told me, when they are when they sleep pleasantly together, then they're happy. And so we kept on talking, and I said, they don't always sleep. No, they don't always sleep. How do you know they are happy when they don't sleep? Oh, well, then they explore my bedroom, he said. when they're walking around, and then I started to, I already knew how the research was actually done. All these tests are perseverance tests. Here you have them, the tail suspension tests. A mouse or a rat, they are hung on their tails. And the harder they fight against their fate, the better the antidepressant is the idea. You might as well say the better they keep quiet, the better the antidepressant. And this one, the forced swimming test, the harder they struggle against drowning, the better the antidepressant. It's swimming, struggling, and floating. Computers measure it. Here, maybe it's a little. I'll let him swim for you. it was. What am I doing? Well, okay. You look it up on YouTube. You will get very harsh ones. I have one, and the camera is on the face of the animal. But then people in my audience, it was an audience of hundreds of psychotherapists, some said later on, you shouldn't show us, it's awful. Because you see the panic on the face of the animal. And it shits in the water. So it's really, really unpleasant. But they do get saved, of course, because they're expensive. And I'm not wanting to, right now, I'm not wanting to accuse the people doing these kind of tests of being bad people. But I want to say, whatever definition you use, it's always a definition. And I'm arguing that these definitions create realities. This reality of depression being defined as being showing perseverance, that translates into the medications. And the funny thing is that you can see that in the advertisements for the medications. The advertisements, by the way, are being based on marketing research. Before they design advertisements, the marketing people, they find out what people really want. And it's not easy happiness, as many people argue. They say that people taking antidepressants are whiners. I don't think they are whiners, because if you only look at the advertisements, you can see what people want. Here's an old one. They want to function well. This is a very old advertisement for Ritalin as an antidepressant, because Ritalin has been advertised for everything. And here, before she took the medication, her pile of potatoes was very high. After she took the medication, it was, it can be easily done. So this shows that what she wants is being a good housewife. And you can think that pharmaceutical companies tell you that you should be a good housewife. No, they reflect what people want. And we laugh about this one, but she would have laughed about the present-day ones, because they found out that women these days don't want to peel potatoes, but want to be stars, singers. And they often picture rain, which I find fascinating. These are two with rain. These days, we want to have nature in our own hands. We don't want to have hanging shoulders, nor hanging eyelids, nor irregular teeth, nor irregular minds. So we want to have our biology. It's malleable. And that you can see here, she's working in the sun, and the losers on the back are working in the rain. They don't take the medication yet. SSRIs is the name of the most used antidepressants. SSRI can. So she conquers Doreen. So the test, the definitions reflecting our society are in the heart of the laboratory. You can find them there. There is no fact that isn't based on values and definitions. Well, of course, you can't hang human beings on their tails or drown them nearly. So how are the tests being done with humans? Mostly surveys. But the surveys can't be neutral. The surveys reflect values as well. It's impossible. This is the Hamilton Depression Scale. The feeling, blah, blah, blah. Feelings of guilt, for instance, etc. So they can't be neutral. Why don't we count people's own stories about there or what professionals can see? We think that's subjective. We don't like, in science, we don't like people's own stories. That's a history of objectivity and subjectivity in itself. What counts as objective and what counts as subjective? That's also a matter of definition. And what we these days seem to think counts as objective are brain scans. Is a brain scan more objective or true to nature than talking to somebody? Many people think it is. Here's the University of Nijmegen advertising itself on the front page of NRC Handelsblad. And it says contributions to health. The brain activity, I translated into English. Between healthy people and those with burnout differ. This is what researchers from the Nijmegen University have found. For the first time, it has been proven that burnout truly exists. So we need a brain scan that it truly exists. Well, it depends. Wait a minute. What's going on when you take a brain scan? A person is in a narrow tube. The head is stuck, whereas in everyday life, a head always moves a bit. There, the person watches pictures, for instance, or takes a test. It's extremely noisy. Psychology students told me that Americans react different to homeless people than Dutch people. I said, how do you know? Well, that is a result from fMRI research. Oh, whoa, did they put a homeless person in the tube too? So were the research subjects together with a homeless person there? No, of course not. They looked at pictures of homeless people. It's so different from everyday life. So, and just to tease them, I showed them a cartoon by Matt Groening from The Simpsons. It's this one. It's actually about experimental psychology. Here you see the researchers. They are doing objective observation, and they study love. And there's the research subject. His arms are tight, and there's a little sign of a heart in front of his nose, and then they conclude the little fellow just won't respond to love. And it's not nice to tease them, but there are lots of many brain researchers. I'm not against brain research, and there are many of them who are worried about the popularity and the weird sense of objectivity connected to fMRI research. Here is Logothetis. He says, fundamental questions concerning the interpretation of fMRI data abound, as the conclusions drawn often ignore the actual limitations of the methodology. The methodology is measuring oxygen in blood flow in the brain. And this article is about what does that actually mean? We don't even know what it means. Does it really mean extra activity in the brain? We don't even know that. So there's a lot of discussion among the honest researchers going on. And here is Rien van Meulen. He's the former head of the American University Hospital. And I heard him say, migraine is not visible in the scan. Does that mean it doesn't exist? You only have to look at the patients when they have an attack. They're very, very, very ill, whereas the scan doesn't show anything. And he also argued even a tumor is not visible on a scan. The only thing we see is a black spot. And we need all other kinds of information to interpret the black spot to be sure that it is, that we should call it a tumor. So you also need clinical observations. Here is the Critical Neuroscience Network. These are young neuroscientists, and they did a great job in establishing this Critical Neuroscience Network because they are very much aware of these issues, and they want to do honest research, and they want to talk with non-academics. And I was at a conference when a professor my age really scorned them. He was so nasty. He talked for 5 minutes about, I was critical when I was young too, but, you know, I've outgrown this, etc. So I've been talking about realism at the beginning of the 20th century, and now a new expression is being used by sociologists of science like Bruno Latour, which is realistic realism or neo-realism. Only if we acknowledge that science shapes reality can we have a democratic discussion on what kind of reality we want. And you can see this in all kinds of reports. I sent Leven some links to these kind of reports now of quite some other people arguing that there should not be a public understanding of science. There should be a public understanding of the social dimensions of science. And here's another one. The task is to make visible the invisible. I'll send you the PDF of the PowerPoint, and you have the references. To expose to public scrutiny the assumptions, values, and visions that drive science. And I would like to add to that that scientists need to... Oh, no, that's them. Need to find ways of listening to and valuing more diverse forms of public knowledge and intelligence. That's what they argue, and I like to add that it needs to come from both sides. Real interest in science is needed, one that does not just admire, nor one that just ridiculizes, because if you tell people that science cannot reflect reality, then they often react, oh, then it's worthless. And, of course, we shouldn't go in that direction. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking with us till the end. The next speaker is Ruud Abma, who will talk about the Diederik Stapel case and fraud in experimental psychology. Until then, happy perceptions!